The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So this evening I'd like to continue the series of talks that I'm giving on concentration practice. So this is the second talk, and I'll give the third one in the three-part series in 2 weeks. I won't be here next week. Next week, Kevin Griffin will come and give the talk. So the Buddha in the ancient scriptures that survive, at least, gave very pointed encouragement and instructions for people to develop their concentration. He said that one of the advantages of a concentrated mind is a concentrated mind is able to see things as they are. And the ability to see clearly, to have insight, is one of the important aspects of Buddhist spirituality, Buddhist spiritual practice, to clear the dust from our eyes, to clear the obscurations, to clear the agitation and the projections and the delusions that often accompany our ability to see, and to be able to see things as they are in a very clear way. And in Buddhism, this ability to see clearly is one of the steps towards liberation, one of the that helps the freeing of the heart, the mind. And concentration practice is seen as one of the important means to help us see clearly how things are. Some people, I'm not sure what the Buddha had in mind, but the Buddha also said there's no need to fear concentration, no need to be afraid of it. And I do know there are people who get afraid of it. Some people are afraid of it because generally when this concentration gets strong, it involves an altered state of consciousness. And some people find that a bit disconcerting, disorienting, to enter into a state of consciousness that's a state of mind that's different than what we're habituated in. And some people only feel safe if they stay in the habitual habits of their mind, activities of the mind, various thoughts they have, ways of thinking about themselves, ways of thinking about the world. But as mind gets concentrated, there's less and less thinking that goes on. And if you depend on your safety, well-being, comfort, security, thinking certain ways, then it's some people find it a bit challenging to no longer be thinking actively those ways. And so the people get a little bit can get frightened by that or resistant. And it takes a while sometimes for people to work through that fear and be able to realize it's actually quite safe and beautiful to be able to settle the mind temporarily in meditation in a very deep place where there's very little thinking going on. Some people get afraid of concentration because they're afraid of getting attached to it. And Buddhism puts big emphasis on the suffering that comes from being attached, clinging tightly to things. And we cling to our ideas, we cling to our desires, we cling to pleasure. And concentrated states of mind in meditation are generally quite pleasant. Sometimes they're extremely pleasant. And so they're very satisfying states. And some people are afraid that if they go into those states, they'll get attached to them. And that will be to their disadvantage. So I think it's instructive the Buddha said, don't be afraid of concentration. And what I've seen is that you don't need to be afraid of it because there are problems that can crop up with doing concentration practice of various kinds, but the whole process is self-correcting. So with a further practice, it works itself out. That you iron out the problems and you can continue. And it's usually quite satisfying. So an important part, as I said last week, of concentration is not kind of a laser-like one-pointed concentration of the mind, but rather it's what's called a unification or a gathering together of all the different aspects of our psychophysical being. In exactly the same way as when you'd have, for some reason, really intense interest in something. Sometimes if there's a danger, you get really interested. And all your faculties are absorbed in dealing with this mountain lion that's walking down the street. And you're not thinking about, your childhood sweetheart anymore. You're not thinking about where you're going to get your next job. You're not thinking about, you know, all kinds of things that normally you'd think about, what to eat for dinner. But you're just thinking about that mountain lion, and everything's, all your senses are focused on safety and taking care of this. Sometimes interest can be zeroed in quite strongly, when not because of danger, but because of very intense desire. And I still remember very well how incredibly focused my attention was around pursuing young women when I was a teenager. I once went through the whole telephone book. I went from the front to the back, and my friend went from the back to the front, and all we knew was her first name and the street she lived on. And so we called every house that lived at, you know, every phone number that associated with that street, and asked for her. And about halfway through the phone book, we found her. So, you know, that takes a lot of, certainly persistence, but... So desire can get you focused as well. Some people can have very satisfying experiences of being concentrated, absorbed, unified around something when they're doing an activity that they're very interested in and enjoying, like sometimes reading a book. Some people find they can get absorbed in the world of the book, and time disappears, the world around them kind of disappears, and kind of like everything, their world gets kind of condensed or composed or settled on just the story that they're reading. And sometimes it's quite pleasant, not because the story is necessarily a great story, but because of the psychophysical sensations that come into play when the mind gets concentrated. People who are hobbyists will find this sometimes as well. When they really get into the hobby, you get focused, and it's not like you're super concentrated, but your interest is strong enough and your involvement is strong enough that everything gets unified, everything gets collected. You're not thinking about anything else except doing the hobby that you might be doing. So it's the same with meditation. That it really helps to be really interested in what you're doing. And if you're interested in something else, if you're interested in what to have for dinner, or you're interested in your childhood sweetheart, or you're interested in being angry at your neighbor for playing loud music, or if you're interested in more interested in what's in television, there's a whole, you know, long list of things you could, you know, people are interested in. And when you sit down to meditate, you'll find out very quickly what your mind's interested in. And sometimes it's quite humbling, sometimes it's quite embarrassing to find out how much energy the mind puts in around certain thoughts and concerns. And what needs to happen in order to develop concentration in meditation is that your interest in the practice needs to be greater than the interest in these other things. There has to be a switch. And some people who meditate are not really clear about this kind of switch that needs to happen, this switch of where the primary focus is. And at least if you understand the principle, I'm supposed to be interested in my meditation now, in being here and now, rather than being interested in there and then. That helps to have know that principle. It doesn't necessarily mean you can still do it, but at least if you know that's the idea, then there's some hope. If you don't know that, then you might think that's really important to gallop off into your thoughts. And then one of the things that happens is the mind gets concentrated. We let go of, best we can, of the things we're thinking about that have nothing to do with the meditation, nothing to do with here and now and being present. And that's a big training, and it might take a while to have that training of letting go, letting go, letting go. And you might have to let go 10,000 times before something in the mind begins to release, relax, soften. It's not uncommon for some people to have the experience of, if they say they sit for 40 minutes, meditate for 40 minutes, to find that the first 20 minutes perhaps, or the first 30 minutes maybe, the mind is actually quite active still and busy and thinking a lot. And there's a big process of bringing the mind back, letting go of your thinking, bringing the mind back to the breath perhaps, the focus. And it just seems like you're doing that over and over again. And then something after a certain period of time gets settled or releases or relaxes. And then for the last period of meditation, sometimes people feel, finally I'm here, I've let go, I'm not so caught up in all those concerns. I did this many years ago when someone gave my wife and I tickets to the symphony. I don't go to the symphony very much. I hadn't, you know, wasn't something I was familiar with that much. But we got very relatively good seats that let us, at least I thought it was, that made it, helped us look kind of down from the side into the, I guess it's called the pit, orchestra pit. And since I wasn't familiar with this kind of experience, I was fascinated what was going on in that orchestra pit. And I was, my mind was kind of commenting on everyone, the violin players and the flute players, and watching what they're doing. And I was so fascinated what was going on that I wasn't listening to the music. And after a while, I realized, I'm not listening to the music. I have to listen to the music. So I tried listening to the music. My mind got involved in the, you know, the people in the orchestra pit. And so finally, I thought, you know, I'm not here to watch, you know, watch the, them play their music. I'm here to listen to the music more than watch. So in order to really have the ability to focus on it, I closed my eyes so that I wouldn't be distracted by what was going on. And that helped a lot. And then I can take in the music and be present for it. And then my mind settled down. And the wanting mind, the desiring mind, the clinging mind that wanted to understand and do and comment on things finally quiet down. And then after the intermission, my mind was settled enough that I could listen to the music and keep my eyes open. But it took some intervention on my part to kind of overcome this strong tendency of my mind to be thinking and involved and commenting and judging everything that I could see. So sometimes it takes a while to settle down. But as we, so important part of this concentration practice is learning to switch our attention from what we think is important to, at least in principle, understanding what's important is here and now and the focus of meditation, and try to be more interested in that and the other interests we can have. It's not an easy thing to do, but it partly involves a willingness then to let go of the things that are more, seemingly more interested, the mind is fascinated by. Let go, let go, let go. And try to then focus, and something relaxes and gives. And then beginning to kind of settle more fully on this experience that we're focusing on, but not focus with this laser, you know, like we're looking, boring down at it. But the idea around concentration that I like is composure, to become composed on the experience. And I'm very fond of the idea that the word samadhi in Sanskrit or Pali is very close. The way that it's constructed, the word sam means with, and the di or adi means a kind of a, and the root word meaning of it means to stand. And so the same thing for composure. To come is with, and pose could means to stand. So so this idea that, you know, etymologically they kind of related. And so the idea of being composed on the experience is an important part of samadhi or concentration in Buddhism. And what composure means for me, and why I like it, is it's something that's integrated with all my being. I'm going to compose myself. It's something I do very much with my body, compose myself around the experience. Take a deep breath, relax, take a little bit different posture that allows me to be grounded, settled, stable in the situation that I'm in. Compose means you're not kind of awkward anymore in your body. You're not kind of disconnected to different parts of your body or imbalanced in your body. There's a balance and a grace with being composed and settled. And so to be concentrated on the breathing, for example, is to compose oneself on the breath. And when I compose myself on breathing, then it's kind of like I try to get into a posture, I try to feel it, I try to settle into it physically with my body. I try to let my body be the means by which I concentrate, as opposed to being the inner eye that looks to get concentrated. It's more of a kinesthetic sense of settling and composing myself around the experience. The attention, the inner kind of eye in a sense, is part of what gets focused on it, but it's only one thing. So as this begins to happen, as the mind begins to concentrate and settle, there's a number of wonderful things that can happen. One is that we conserve a lot of energy. A fragmented mind, agitated mind, takes up a lot of energy. I don't know what the exact number is, but I've read that in physiological studies that one of the biggest energy consumers in the human body is the brain. And a lot of our thinking and a lot of the reactivity and emotions that the brain produces is where a lot of the energy goes. As the mind gets concentrated and unified and settled and calm, there's not a lot of energy needed anymore for your neurosis. Or, you know, those of you who are not neurotic, at least, you know, for some all the concerns and things you're chasing with your mind and spinning around about. And so as the mind gets concentrated, there's a wonderful energy gets released in the system. There's more energy available for the practice of concentration, where energy is not being dispersed or fragmented or draining out of us. And there's a kind of feeling of kind of aliveness and buoyance and that begins to happening in the body when we start getting concentrated in a good way. I find that when I get concentrated well, that I need to sleep less. And my sleep needs go down. On retreat, when I'm meditating most of the day, I can get by quite happily with about 4.5 hours a night. And for long periods of time, where I can't do that in daily life. And even in daily life, the quality of my sleep is a little bit dependent on the quality of my meditation. The more focused my meditation is, more settled and concentrated it is, the better my sleep is. Some people on retreat, not everyone has reduced sleep through meditation, but sometimes it's much more dramatic than with me. I've known people who've gone 2 hours a night for weeks on end because there's so little need for that, whatever it is that sleep does for a renewal, refreshment, recovery, processing, or whatever goes on in that area. And people manage fine with that kind of very low level of sleep. Sitting at, 40 minutes, half an hour every day, I don't know how much you'll get of that benefit, but I've certainly meditated sometimes and meditated through my tiredness and felt completely refreshed from the experience of meditating. So, so what's needed to get concentrated? Frontal assaults on getting concentrated seldom work. So to say, I'm going to get concentrated and then, or all else, and really kind of bore down and try, is not a very effective way. So there's one story that I like in this regard. I have two stories to tell. I apologize, they're about men, both of them, but maybe you won't mind when you hear the stories. So it was a monk. It was a young aristocratic youth, quite capable, smart, competent, had done a lot in his life, and was very successful in everything he did. And he decided that maybe because he was so successful, that things in the world kind of lost some interest for him, he decided to go to the monastery and pursue enlightenment. So he entered the monastery, and the abbot asked him, "Why are you here?" And he said, "I'm here to become enlightened." And then he asked the abbot, "How long will it take?" And the abbot said, "Oh, probably about 10 years." And then he said to the abbot, "Oh, but I'm quite capable. I can put in a lot of effort. I can try really hard. If I really make an effort and try hard at getting enlightened, how long will it take?" "Oh, in that case, it'll take about 20 years." There's something about trying hard and using the ego and using the self-conscious effort that interferes with meditation. And it's very hard sometimes to learn the art of making good, healthy effort and not be too self-conscious about it. And part of being self-conscious about it is being too caught up in the goal, trying to accomplish something and do something, trying to prove oneself. And it takes a while to learn the art of doing unself-conscious effort or making effort which isn't mixed up with a lot of desire and clinging and wanting and pushing and measuring oneself. And so how to make effort without making effort almost is kind of the challenge. So the other story is a man, another man, who was quite wasn't so successful in everything he did, was challenged in his life, had a lot of crises and tragedies in his life. Things didn't work out for him very well. And he was in quite a bit of despair. And didn't get much training, much education in his life, much support, much mentorship, kind of. And somehow he ended up in the monastery as a last resort, last stop. And so the abbot then asked him, welcomed him into the monastery, and he said to him, do you have any talents? Do you have any skills? And the guy said, no. I never developed myself, never did anything. I was actually kind of lazy. I mostly spent a lot of time playing Go, which is Chinese chess, kind of a chess game. And that's what I did with my time. And the abbot said, oh, okay. So I know what you need. So in order to learn the monastic life and the path to liberation, you need to get concentrated. You need what that's a lot like. And you're going to learn it through your ability to play chess. And so he called into the room the oldest monk in the monastery, someone who had practiced for many years, a lovely man, a loving man, a very peaceful, settled man, kind person, very old. And he sat them down, other opposite sides of the table, with a chessboard between them. And then the abbot went and got a sword. And he put the sword down the table. And he said very seriously, he said, the two of you are to play chess. Whoever loses, I'm going to cut off your head. So it's like, you know, playing chess to the death, right? So they started playing, and they were pretty well paired and matched, and it was going back and forth for a long time. And talk about being concentrated. Very focused, you know, those kinds of stakes, you're pretty interested. So he was really focused, and both players were really focused. The sweat was going down their face, and they were really present. And at some point, it seemed like that the young man had the advantage. And it looked like, you know, clearly he was, you know, only a few steps away from winning the game. And then he looked up at the old man, and he saw his years of practice, his kindness, his love. He felt like, you know, he felt this great compassion for this person. And so then the young man began to misplay so that he'd lose. And the abbot who was watching, when he saw what was going on, he reached over and he flipped over the chessboard. And he said, no winners and no losers. And then he turned to the young man and said, in order to succeed here in this monastery, you need two qualities. You need concentration and you need compassion. You need both. So it's kind of a dramatic story, but the story to make this point about the mutuality, the mutual support of these two aspects, concentration and compassion, concentration and kindness. And the people who get in trouble by trying to be self-consciously concentrated usually don't have a lot of don't bring to bear a lot of compassion in what they're doing. And sometimes they get very harsh about themselves. They feel very bitter about themselves, because I'm not good enough. I can't do this. I'm not proving myself. But infinite compassion. So we don't have to be in a hurry. We don't have to be successful. We're able to handle the difficulty in getting concentrated, all the challenges of it, and hold it in a very forgiving mind, hold it in a very compassionate, caring mind, permissive mind almost, and not be in a hurry, not forcing ourselves into it. And it might be that before we can get concentrated, we need to spend a lot of time being very supportive of ourselves, kind to ourselves, allowing. And for some people, that's the struggle, is to learn how to have this kind of kind regard, soft regard. Some people find that this emphasis, compassion, kindness, the soft kind of attitude, forgiving attitude toward self, begins sounding a little bit like Hallmark meditation. And that's not what's meant, and sometimes it can require a lot of discipline to keep coming back and trying to overcome the harshness and the criticalness that some people carry with them, and to soften and relax it. But what we're trying to do is to create a with the compassion and its kind of family of emotions and attitudes, we're trying to create a atmosphere in the mind and the heart, a context in the mind and the heart, where we're not in conflict with ourselves. We're not fighting ourselves. We're not hating ourselves, or we're not caught up in things. It's very difficult to get concentrated if the inner life is in conflict, if the inner life is harsh, the inner life is afraid, if the inner life is critical and angry. So sometimes, a lot of time needs to be spent to kind of somehow find a way to re-establish a kind of a healthy inner sense of atmosphere or place, so the mind feels it's okay to get concentrated, can do the work in a nice way. So I'll tell you another story that I'm fond of, a real one this time, of a simple kind of, it's more like an analogy thing. But when my son was in kindergarten, they would once a week make things with beeswax. And there was a whole process in which the kids would use the beeswax. The beeswax would be sitting on a shelf and be hard and cold because they had, and the first thing they had to do is they would hold the beeswax in their hand, between the two palms of their two hands, and just hold it there while the teacher told them a story. And the beeswax would get warm being held in their hands until it was warm enough that it got soft enough that they can begin to shape it. And then they would shape it and stretch it and do the things they had to do until finally they would make it into something beautiful. And then they'd put it back up on the shelf for next week. So the same thing, I think sometimes when we meditate, that sometimes we sit down to meditate and we're hard and brittle. And if you try to shape the beeswax before it's soft, it only breaks. And if you try to get concentrated before you're soft, you'll only break. And I've known people, meditators, who have been so gung-ho in getting concentrated that literally, I don't know if literally is the right word, but they describe something in their brain, in their mind, breaking because they pushed so much, trying so hard, and ways that were not so good for them psychologically for some time. So they're kind of pushing too hard, something breaks. But rather what you want to do is you want to kind of create kind of the warmth in your own mind and your heart and find a way to begin. It's a slow process, not necessarily easy, to hold yourself like in the palms of your hands, metaphorically, to let something relax and to soften. And only when something relaxes and softens can you begin doing the training of concentration, the work of concentration, that then begins creating the mind into something beautiful. And that's one of the things that happens with concentration, is the more concentrated you get, this right concentration that Buddhist meditation leads to, the mind, the heart, the inner life, in a sense, subjectively, starts feeling more and more beautiful. Some of the most beautiful inner states of mind inner states of being that you can experience are states of being that come from being concentrated. And it's quite a transformative thing for a person to experience this tremendous sense of inner beauty and well-being that can come with concentration, because it puts a lot of other things in context. It kind of, the value of other things that doesn't provide us that level of well-being. So one of the things that's required, one other thing that I found really helpful for developing concentration and meditation is to realize that I have to make my effort. I have to do something. I have to focus on the object of concentration. I have to let go. I have to come back. I have to kind of be relaxed, soft. But what I've learned is not to take responsibility for the concentration. When I take responsibility for getting concentrated, it's up to me. I'm the one who's going to get myself concentrated. I generally tie myself in knots. And maybe that's a peculiar shortcoming of me. Maybe none of you have that, but I suspect it's common for a lot of people. And I find it's best for me not to take responsibility. I have to do my effort. I can't just kind of sit back and, daydream. But I have to do my best effort. It's kind of like I don't expect to get concentrated, or I don't try to get concentrated, or I don't think it's up to me. I just do the work, the meditation. And then at some point there starts to be an inner shift that feels a little bit kind of like, I'm not doing this, it's a gift. And so for me, when I get concentrated, I have the added benefit of the experience that it feels like a gift. And it's quite lovely to feel this that this beautiful thing is being gifted to me. Gifted because that's this feeling I have, because I didn't make it. I create the conditions that allow it to happen, but I don't make it. So in this regard, I'm fond of the movie from long ago called The Field of Dreams. And the kind of the refrain was, build it and he will come. So we build something, and then the concentration comes. That's more the spirit in which I like to get concentrated. So we build relaxation. Last week I talked about the importance of ethics. We begin to hold ourselves with warmth so something can relax. We kind of try to find ourselves and be as composed as we can in the experience. We have enough understanding and reflection. We realize that thinking about there and then is not what we're doing in constant, when we're developing meditation. We're trying to be here and now. And then we're trying also to begin composing ourselves or concentrating ourselves on a particular object of concentration or subject of concentration. And there's it's important to understand in order to get concentrated, you need to have something that you're gathering yourself around, unifying around. And so there's a big range of things that can be that have that function. One of the classic functions for concentration is focuses of concentration is breathing. To focus on the breath, keep coming back and being with the breath. When we're focusing on the breath as a concentration object, a very common practice is to count the breath. So every time I count every time I exhale, I give one count, one, and then next exhale, two, up to 10. If you lose count, the idea is just don't worry, don't be concerned about it, just begin again at one. And if you get to 10, you get to begin again at one. And so you just keep doing that. And there's something about keeping track of 1 to 10 that requires you to be a little more focused than if you're not counting at all. And so it tends to keep people more engaged. Some people like to count both the inhalation and the exhalation. The way that I've known people to do it is mostly they count 1 for the inhalation, 1 for the exhalation, 2, 2, 3, 3, that way. Because if they don't count both the inhalation and exhalation, then the one you don't count, that's the place where the mind's going to start thinking about something. So you want to keep the mind engaged, so this counting. It also gives the thinking mind something to do so that it's not going to be thinking about something else, which can be helpful. And so I've done a lot of breath counting. That's what I was taught in my early years of Buddhist practice, was to count the breath. And I found it very beneficial for me and kind of helped cultivate, develop my ability to get concentrated. Another focus of concentration is loving kindness practice. In our tradition, at least, that's kind of one of the primary, besides the breath, primary objects of concentration is to do this loving kindness meditation. Where generally, in our tradition, we're using phrases that we're focusing on, and so that's a whole practice in itself. And there are some other things that people use as objects, but that's, as I said, the most common ones. One of the hindrances to developing concentration is boredom. And I think a lot of people have to go through a period of time of being bored because there's a shift from the things we're usually interested in to focusing on something that we're not innately interested in. Like if you're focusing on the breath, for most people the breath isn't as interested as, and isn't as interesting as TV or food or sex or money or status or, recreational opportunities and a lot of things you can be more interesting. And so to switch to something that's, not so inherently interesting as the breath, sometimes there's a boredom arises. And boredom then can be uncomfortable and can be a strong motivator to stop what you're doing and go back to what you're more interested in. And so sometimes you have to deal with boredom. One of the aspects of boredom is that boredom is sometimes considered to be a subtle form of aversion. And if you think of it that way, maybe you're more likely willing to work through it. But with all objects of concentration, once you start getting focused, when the distracting mind settles down, relaxes, and you start getting focused and absorbed, gathered together, it starts getting very interesting. And the interest gets so strong that it's sometimes described in English as having zest. A kind of joy and delight arises. And generally that zest or that joy or that enthusiasm or that with concentration becoming strong, becomes much stronger than it can reading your interesting novel or doing your hobby. It can get actually sometimes quite intense, very satisfying. And it becomes more and more interesting, not because the breath becomes interesting more and more in a sense, but rather because of the subjective experience, the inner experience of well-being that's clearly connected to being focused on the breath feels so good. And so, you know, it's very compelling. Probably there's a lot of wonderful chemicals being released in your body, serotonin and oxytocin, all kinds of things that get released that help support this wonderful feeling, softness and warmth and tingling and lightness that can happen as we get concentrated. So the last thing I'll say, it's 9 o'clock, is to say that the focus in when we're doing concentration practice is on the subjective inner experience that comes with the practice. The focus when we do mindfulness practice by itself without too much interest in concentration is not so much the subjective experience, but rather it's the seeing clearly what is happening. It's more, in a sense, it's more the objective experience, even though it's your own experience subjectively in a sense, you're more focusing on seeing what's there. Whereas in mindfulness, you're more focused on feeling how you feel. And so as we develop concentration practice, the subjective experiences begin to change in a way that is evoked by the concentration. And then learning how to read that and understand those subjective changes is one of the things that then helps support further concentration. So next week, in 2 weeks from now, I'll talk about how to read and do this biofeedback kind of system, biofeedback loop, with your own subjective experiences. You don't have to read it and understand it as a way that supports getting more settled, calmer, more relaxed, more focused in the concentration practice. And then some of the inner practices that can work to help support you go further and further into this inner realm. So I hope that was understandable, and I hope you stayed interested enough, concentrated enough. If not, Dharma talks can also be seen as a place to cultivate your concentration. The mind wanders away, you come back. So, thank you.